Okay,
hiya.
My name's James Nichols. I'm a European patent attorney. I've been working training as a patent attorney for 4 years now. And my firm's J.A. Kemp & Co. I just want to talk to you sort of briefly about the patent process, what a patent is, if you don't know already, and the kind of process you have to go through to do that. Kind of relationship you have with an inventor when he comes to you with his initial idea, and how you translate that into getting legal protection. And then I'm just going to give you some sort of general comments on the day-to-day work and sort of the kind of career it is. This is just some nice pictures of our offices in London, Munich and Oxford. The reason we've got an office in Munich is that a lot of our work is for the European Patent Office, who are based there. And it's quite convenient to have a base because you have hearings that are held in Germany, in Munich. Okay, so starting off, what is a patent? You may know already. And more broadly, what is intellectual property? I'm only going to focus on patents because that's what I do. But there's various forms of protection you can get for any form of new idea or intellectual creation you have. And they can either be things where you need to actually actively register them, like patents, trademarks, or designs, or there's some rights that arise automatically, like copyrights, and you don't have to do anything to register them. Okay, so a patent is a contract between a state and an applicant. I'll explain that in a bit more detail, but basically, as an applicant, you have to make a full disclosure of your invention, and in as a quid pro quo for that, the state will grant you a monopoly right for exploitation of the invention. And it's a negative right, so it's quite important, because often people think you can apply for a patent, and having applied for that patent, you'll be able to do anything in relation to that invention you've claimed. But often a third-party patent may sort of dominate already your invention and stop you from actually exploiting your invention. So it doesn't guarantee that you'll be able to exploit your invention. It just means that you can stop other people from using the specific invention you've claimed. And people use the negative right in different ways, so depending on who owns the patent. If it's a university, you've got no interest in exploiting the patent commercially, they're never going to manufacture a drug. They're going to make money by licensing the patent to someone. So licensing the right to work under the patent, and they're going to make royalty revenues from that. For pharmaceutical companies, where it's very important, they've got a blockbuster drug, and it's very important for them to be the only players on the market. They're actively going to use that right negatively to stop anyone from working the invention at all. So they're interested in being the only people working the invention. A patent's got a limited duration, so it's 20 years. There's some slight exceptions for medicinal products in particular, in that you can get a 5-year extension taking up to 25 years, but that only extends the patent to the particular drug you've marketed. And the reason for that is that often the regulatory process holds up. It takes a long time before you can actually sell your drug, and so the state sort of compensates you for that delay in having protection for your drug on the market by granting you a slight extension. Patents are territorial, which adds a sort of great deal of complexity. Often people will have patents in many different countries around the world, and in particular, sort of big pharmaceutical companies might file in 64 countries around the world, where it's very important for them to cover all potential markets. And from our side of things, it complicates things a lot, because you have to have a filing strategy that takes into account all these different countries. They each have slightly different legal systems, but there are sort of basic principles in common. And the other thing is, it makes it very expensive, because you have to have local agents in each country for an inventor, for an applicant company who really want to get worldwide protection. It's a very expensive thing to do. And so let's briefly summarise the requirements for patent protection. The main requirements is the invention is new, and the standard for what is new can differ, but in the UK, basically, anything that's been made available to the public worldwide in any language before you've filed your application can be cited against you and stop you from getting a patent. An invention, a patented invention also has to be inventive, so that means it's not got to be obvious having regard to the common general knowledge. Industrially applicable, which most things are, and not excluded by statute, and so there's specific exclusions to patents for reasons of public policy, things like methods of medical treatment. The people who drafted the patent statute thought it would be a good idea to let surgeons operate on people without fear of being legally challenged, so they stopped people from patenting methods of treatment. Another thing is something like an artistic work, because that's protected separately by copyright. It's excluded from patent protection. Okay, so coming back to this sort of basic contract, as I said, what you need to do is disclose to the world how your invention works, and you need to make a full disclosure, because it would be a bit unfair if you basically filed an application and you thereby stopped other people from doing it, but you didn't give enough details for people to be able to replicate the invention after your patent term had run out. So you need to make a what's called a fully kind of enabling disclosure that would allow someone to repeat your invention. You need to give sufficient details for that. And so in return for making that contribution to the public domain and telling them how your invention works and not keeping it secret, you get to define by a series of what are called claims, kind of flag posts that demarcate exactly what you want to protect and stop other people from doing. And that's the main skill you acquire as a patent attorney, is the ability to evaluate a client's invention and define it in a series of words that protect the general features of the invention, so protect what they've specifically done, but also protect sort of a broader periphery where the client might expand and usefully want to have protection when their development program is advanced in a few years' time. And it's particularly important to provide kind of a lot of different definitions of the invention, because and a lot of different kind of, we call them fallback positions, that define the invention more narrowly, more broadly. Because at the time you file your application, you may not know what else has been published worldwide. And if something is cited against you, like a Chinese application, you need to have some sort of basis to differentiate yourself from that. And you're not allowed to change the language you've used to describe your invention after you've filed it. So basically, you need to kind of foresee potential problems and provide a reasonable degree of protection and ways you can defend your patent position at a later date, depending on what happens. Okay, so this is a fictional example that I'm just going to talk about. It's actually taken from an exam, so it's not particularly interesting, but so basically these things here are bricks, and imagine your client comes to you with this drawing and says, I've got some really great bricks, and you can kind of see the bricks have got the different shape to normal bricks. They've got some protrusions at the top and the bottom, and your client explains to you that when he made bricks like this, they had the advantage that they were less likely to fall over when they're stacked, that the protrusions made it easier for the bricks to align automatically when building, so that had advantage making straight walls. And then also the protrusions make these gaps that allow for a spaced mortar to set. So you've got all these different advantages you can see of the bricks. And I guess that will set you thinking about how you could look at claiming bricks more broadly that don't have the specific shape shown in the figures, but have the same properties that the client wants. Because obviously, if you'd claimed just bricks having this exact shape and put a picture of it, someone could just change the shape slightly and they would no longer fall in the scope of your claim. So you've got to try and generalize out the essential features of the invention, basically. Okay, so this is the drafting process. So the clients talk to you about their new idea, and he's talked to you importantly about what he thinks is original and advantageous having regard to what people have done before. And starting from that, you could sort of look at, try and map out in your head what main features the inventions have. So the main features appear to be these bumps at the top and bottom, and the fact that they can interact somehow to give you these advantages. Think now about how to describe, you know, this particular system of stacking bricks, what kind of wording you could use. And other than the specific example the client's given you, you would look to ask him, you know, what other ways, how else could you shape your bricks? Do you think this would work if it was a different shape, this kind of thing? So by doing that, you're building up a description of the invention, so a detailed representation of the invention, and starting from the very specific example the client's given, other ways the invention could be performed. By doing that, you're sort of defining a number of features and a number of alternative ways that you could then introduce into the claims if necessary at a later stage to, you know, to protect other specific ways of carrying out the invention. So that's all very well. You can think about how the invention works and how you describe it, but when it comes to actually claiming the invention, you need to use kind of a very concise form of wording that sums up the features of the invention. This is quite a difficult skill to acquire. It takes you, I guess, a couple of years. And you're always improving the way in which you draft and describe inventions. But one way of going about it would be to look back again at the features and say which of those are actually essential for the invention to work. I mean, is it really essential that these bits at the top have this particular shape? No, it doesn't look like it. So how can I claim the sort of concept of interacting shapes more broadly? And in general, often in particularly in mechanical inventions like this one, you'll end up with very functional language which defines how particular features of the invention interact together to give you the advantage that you've described in your specific example. Right, so this is the possible claim the examiner's had in the exam. I'll give you a chance to have a quick read through it. It probably seems a bit incomprehensible because it's not really a common way of people use to talk about bricks. And there's some sort of patent jargon, like the word comprising. But basically, if you've now looked at it, I can sort of go back and try and explain a bit how the claim works. So obviously a brick, comprising is just means includes, it's just a patent jargon, an upper surface and a lower surface, each of said surfaces being formed so as to cooperate with the said other surface of an adjacent brick. So here, going back to the picture, you can see we had an upper surface and a lower surface, and in the claim, we've not said what shape they are at all, we're to say they're formed in a way that they can cooperate with the other surface. So you're covering any way, any shapes. You can see that that obviously offers you a lot broader protection than limiting to this particular shape. And then such that an interlock is formed by placing one brick on top of another brick. What does that mean? I'm not sure. But maybe it means that you've got, you're preventing slippage of the bricks against each other. Maybe it means that you're creating a space for mortar. But anyway, that's one way you could think about defining it. But you can come up with various definitions, include as many as you want if you'd like to. But generally, when you settle the claims with the inventor, you want to come up with a way of defining the invention which is covers what they do. It covers them, provides them a reasonable degree of protection for future work, and to stop other people from stealing their idea. But also, taking into account the different requirements that patent offices have, you're not going to, you, you will sort of phrase your claim accordingly as well. Okay, so we've discussed the brick with the inventor. There may be several rounds going back and forth with the inventor saying, what do you think about this way of describing it? He'll say, I like that a bit, but how about if we expand this definition? And eventually he'll agree, or you and him will agree, a way forward. You'll have finalised the text for your application and you'll file it at the Patent Office. In some period of time, the Patent Office will conduct a search for prior art. So this is anything, so publications, printed publications, or any disclosures like an abstract of a conference, or maybe some sales of a product in Taiwan. So they'll search in databases for anything that seems to read on to what you're claiming, or possibly also that would make it obvious to do what you've claimed. And they'll provide you with a report. That report will list the documents they think are relevant, and your job is then to, and they'll raise objections based on them. They'll say your invention's not new, your invention's obvious, because if you looked at this document and this other document, it wouldn't take any sort of particular effort to get where your client's got. So your client's not added anything to the world, and so he doesn't deserve a patent. So let's think about a fictional scenario where the Patent Office cites Lego against you for this claim. Do you think that's right? Do you think Lego is covered in that claim? Does anyone have any thoughts?
Depends how you're defining brick, if it's specific to building materials or not.
Yes, well, it just says a brick, so, I mean, a reasonable interpretation is that it covers any form of sort of somewhat rectangular object and doesn't have to be any particular size. If you'd wanted to say a building brick, you could have said it in the claim. So, I mean, yeah, it's arguable, but the Patent Office is arguably correct to say that Lego is included there. And Lego has an upper surface with a little raised bit that cooperates with a recess on another bit. So it looks like it might fulfill all the requirements of the claim. And if you hadn't taken the trouble to think about other ways of defining what your client's invention was, then maybe your application would be sort of doomed to failure because you hadn't distinguished it over Lego. But that's why it's important to try and provide as many different ways of amending your basic language as possible to provide you with these fallback positions to get around prior art you might not have thought about. I mean, here the client may have sort of subconsciously taken the idea from Lego, but he may never have thought that Lego would be something relevant to his invention. But from the Patent Office's perspective, it looks like you're trying to claim Lego. So basically, you discuss the prior art that's been cited with the inventor, and you think about how you're going to amend the claims to get around it. So here, maybe one thing you could do is, if you've provided basis in your original text, is to say that the brick is ceramic. Obviously, Lego is not ceramic. But is that really far enough away from Lego? Is it obvious just to use a different material? Or you could think about some way, possibly, of saying that the interlock is big enough to allow mortar to set or something, because obviously Lego just sticks together and doesn't have these gaps. So you come up with some way of distinguishing that you think is a reasonable argument that your invention is different to Lego. The Patent Office will sometimes accept those arguments and agree to grant a patent. That's not the end of it, though, because someone could either challenge your patent after it's been granted. So there's obviously other third parties who see the existence of this patent and are working in the building trade might be a bit worried about it. So there's routes available for them to challenge and knock out your patent. That can either be at the Patent Office itself, which is what I do, or it could be in a national court, which is what Sarah does, and we'll talk about later. Okay, so moving on from the fictional example, this is a real claim. Can anyone guess what it is? Or what it's intended to cover?
Chocolate bar.
Which chocolate bar?
Paris.
Eru, there you go, well done. So, a rigid cellular structure. And if anyone wants to know what sort of real-life claims look like in the biotech field, I've brought an example of an application that's sitting there, and that's to a peptide vaccine for allergy. And there's an exam report, and then there's a response that was filed against that exam report, so you can kind of see how it works for biotech as well. That's what a patent is, and that's how you go about describing an invention so it can be patented. But the patent profession is divided into two areas, so it's patent examiners and patent attorneys. Who are in the right and who are in the wrong depends on what side of the fence you're on. And there's a further division in the patent attorneys between people who work in industry, so these people work in-house in a drug company maybe, and they'll be working closely with their R&D department, and for new development programs they might, you know, have a series of very similar products working in a particular field. Private practice, you're more like a consultant, and universities or small companies might use you to specifically to write patent applications for them and then get them patents granted while you're by advocating their invention at the patent office. And typically in private practice you'll probably have more variety of work because you won't be confined to this particular drug you're working on. Your clients may have all different types of backgrounds, small clients, universities, so you've got a lot of different, a lot of variety there. The patent attorney profession is very small, only 1,500 registered in the UK. 80% of them work in private practice, and there's a few bigger firms, but none bigger than 150 employees, and there'll be quite a few small firms, might only be like 5-10 people. Quite a small intake per year, a maximum of probably 5 new trainees per firm for the bigger firms. A total annual intake of 175. You've got a good chance because you've gone to Oxford. And it helps to do a PhD because that is something that's regarded as useful by patent attorneys because you can understand people's inventions a bit better, probably. The pros and cons of the job, prospects, so the salary's quite good, and maybe in-house you could start off being a patent attorney and then move into more sort of managerial positions, sort of bridging the divide between R&D and development. Intellectual challenge, it is quite challenging sometimes to try and define your client's invention in a way that is different to what's been done before, especially if it's a very small improvement. And it's also a challenge to overcome objections that have been raised by the Patent Office. Sometimes they're bang on and you really have to fight hard to get anything over what's been done before. It's a good way of keeping science outside the lab. So I did a PhD for 4 years, and it wasn't for me at the end of it, but I sort of keep in contact. Each day you'll be working on different inventions, so you keep in contact with the sort of progress of science, but you see it from the commercial perspective, and you see a much broader range of science than you do working on like one project in a lab. Job security, I think it's reasonably recession-proof. Reasonable hours as well. And the cons, the biggest con is exams. Some quite tough exams to get through. I've hopefully just finished the exams, so I did some on Monday and Tuesday, and they could be the final set, fingers crossed. But basically, from start, you have to have 3 years experience before you can sit your European exams in the profession, so it takes a while to get around to doing them. And a lot of firms are good, they have their own study programs, tutorials that will help you get through, but still sort of balancing doing a normal job with also getting through exams can be quite stressful. I guess another con is if you are a real team player and you get a lot out of working with a team of people, it is quite an individual job. You're locked away in your office a lot of the time, buried under a pile of papers, and just trying to figure out things for yourself. Sometimes, particularly for like really difficult cases where there's heaps of paper, you might work in a team of two, maybe a more senior attorney and a younger attorney. A lot of paperwork, kill a lot of trees, and you don't really get out in the woods very much. It's very much an office-based job. And sort of balancing between the two sides of the patent attorney profession, industry and private practice. I'll start off with private practice, that's me. Majority are based in London, but in most big cities in the UK, there'll be at least sort of two or three firms. You will get a higher salary probably than someone at an equivalent level of experience in industry. Tend to be quite small firms, maybe up to 150 people or something. And as I said before, one advantage is the technological diversity. Industry, you can work outside of London, wherever a drug company's based, or in Europe maybe. And you will get obviously perks from working for a large company. And as well as patents, you probably will have a much sort of wider legal diversity in that you'll be involved in negotiating for taking over a company maybe, or so you'll be involved with sort of solicitors and contract lawyers as well and drafting agreements. So starting salary is, I guess, quite good for a graduate, and it sort of ramps up quite a lot when you pass your exams, so that's one incentive to pass them. And then eventually, if you became a partner, you'd be looking at quite a large salary and also a share of the profits of the partnership. The training for the exams. In my particular firm, we have sort of in-house training tutorials given by people who have already passed their exams, and we get sent on a certificate in IP law. I think this is quite a common thing, about 1 year into our employment at Queen Mary, and that gives you some exemptions from your UK exams eventually. And at 3 years, you do your European qualifying exams, and at 4 years, your SEPA ones. My career path, so I was an undergraduate here doing biochemistry, what seems like a very long time ago. I then did a PhD in London at Cancer Research UK, finished that in 2006, and I've been working 4 years, and you can see where I am now, and hopefully no more exams. So just some advice on making your application to join the profession. What they're looking for, they're looking for sort of a good understanding of your technical subject, and they may sort of quiz you on aspects of your field, like, you know, what's an antibody, how does it work, that sort of thing. A PhD can definitely be an advantage, but it's not essential. Clear and accurate use of English, so that it can be helpful to start with, but it's definitely something that you're expected to acquire as you go along. And attention to detail is very important. Patents are very sort of lengthy, complex documents. You need to be able to spot small mistakes or small differences. Commitment. Languages can help. Basically, I don't think they're essential, but the EPO works in English, French, and German, and often you might speak to someone who's French or German, so maybe you could speak to them in that language. You don't need any legal qualification. Going about making an application, so decide which firms you're going to apply to, and you can make basically a speculative application. Often firms won't directly advertise that they've got a vacancy, but if they like you enough, if you send a letter and a CV, they may make a position for you. So it's definitely worth applying, even if there's no position apparently there. And definitely, you know, churn out as many applications as you can, because like I've said, it's a small, there's only a small niche for new uptake of recruits each year, so you need to sort of not put all your eggs in one basket. Interview times, typically January to April. They may give you some sort of written task to test you, to try and test you on skills they think will be useful in patents before the interview. And then quite often you'll start the job in September. And I think you already heard about some of the sources of information. So, any questions?
Two quick questions. If you do the European Patent Office, does that exempt you from some of the CETA exams in the UK?
Yeah, that's the way my firm does it. Basically, we sit our Euro exams first. Yeah. This was in March of this year. And then you only have to sit two UK exams, providing you passed all of them.
And as opposed to what?
As opposed to other firms will make you actually do all the UK exams. Yeah. And there's maybe six or seven of them.
Oh, so it's actually quite a big...
Yeah. So some firms might even make you do both sets, the Euros and the UKs, but it's quite a good approach, I think, to the Euros first, because a lot of the principles are the same between European and UK law. So,
and if it's okay to ask another one, from people starting training, roughly what proportion of people would you reckon would drop out of the profession?
I mean, some people, it's not for them. I mean, in my year, there was two of us in, actually, of six of us across the different subjects, and one of them has dropped out. In the year below, I think more people dropped out. But I think, you know, generally people who have taken an interview will give it a shot for a few years at least.
So you'd say something like 75% or?
I think, yeah, probably 80% of people stay on, I reckon.
Can I ask, did you at any point consider becoming an IP solicitor instead? And if so, why did you decide to become a patent attorney?
I think I was in danger of becoming an internal student, and I would have had to do a law conversion course after my PhD to do that. And I guess I got to the stage where I thought I'd better get a proper job and not do another qualification. So that's the only reason. But it would definitely be an interesting career path also. Yep.
Does it matter if you're not an EU national?
Does it matter if you're not? No, I don't believe so. But it certainly wouldn't stop you from qualifying as a European representative. I think all you need to do is be based in a European country and working for a European company or law firm. No, that's my answer.
Yeah, because at the moment we are studying at a student visa, so would there be any visa regulation?
Maybe if you give me your email address, I'll think about it and get back to you, because it's quite specific. Yep.
Could work for any other patent attorney firm.
I don't know, really. You get to meet other people from other firms on your QM course and exams. I mean, a lot of them, there are more conservative ones. I'd probably say my firm is one of the more conservative ones. I don't know, there's no other patent firm that's been described to me in such glowing terms that I definitely want to work there. So. Yeah, sorry. Yep.
What's the best and worst part of your job?
I think the best part is probably when you've really made a contribution. It's something you've had a really difficult invention to describe, and you've come out with a wording that looks really nice, and also when you get your client really good protection for their invention. So basically, I think one thing that's quite unusual about the job is it's quite, especially in private practices, it's very, very bitty that you'll work on three or four, maybe five different inventions a day for different clients. And it's quite a long process getting a patent. So maybe you draft an application now and you won't actually get it granted for 4 years. So, and you come back to it every now and again. I think what I enjoy the most is the direct client work, which is, actually meeting an inventor and seeing what they want to get out of this new idea they've got, and making a difference for them, and especially small companies, a patent can make a big difference to their investment and get people on board. And without you having a patent that looks good, they may not get the funding they need. I think deadlines, I mean, patents is very deadline driven, and sometimes the patent office will set you deadlines to reply, and sometimes you can just get snowed under with stuff that has to be done on a particular day. I think that's true of law in general. Anyone else? Yeah.
Would you have any advice for the sort of interviews? Because I know it can be quite difficult to look at appearances and go, well, how would you describe that as being a unique item? Have you got any sort of tips for the sort of technical side of the interviews that you might have?
You mean tips for the questions they'll ask you in an interview, preparation? I think probably the most useful preparation you could do, and that I did, is just to try and read up about patents and know a bit more about what they do. Maybe come up with some interesting issues that you've read about to do with patents, and then mention them in the interview. Just show you're on the ball and you know something about the job and about the sort of issues that are hot in sort of patents right now. And technically, I think you've got to be prepared to, one thing if you've done a PhD or some sort of undergraduate project, they might ask you to explain it to them, and often they've got a short attention span. They won't understand all the technical terms, but you've got to try and find a way of getting something complicated and scientific across in simple terms to them. So try and think about a way, if they ask you about your PhD or your project, you know, what the key features are, and how you describe it to someone who doesn't know about science. Yep.
Do many people join the firm straight out of law school, or do they go on to do like a master's or PhD in
It's not a it's not a requirement to have done any sort of legal studies. We don't actually have many, hardly any people, I think, who have a legal background, who become patent attorneys. It's mostly people who've done science degrees or PhDs.
Do you think it's a good or a bad thing that you're working in a profession where the firms are quite small and on a day-to-day basis you don't work with that many people? Do you find that's much of a negative, or do you quite not?
I don't know. I think it really depends on your personality. If you're the kind of person who likes sort of locking yourself away and figuring out a problem, I wouldn't say that patent attorneys are antisocial. I mean, the firm's got a good social good social group. You go out for drinks and stuff. But I think you just you can't sort of be bouncing questions off people the whole time. You've got to figure things out for yourself, and I guess is the main thing. Anyone else? Okay.
How technical are the that people come to you with inventions? Exactly how technical is it on a standard? Like, how difficult? How complex is
I mean, I must admit, I've never worked on an invention where I was really struggling to understand it. It's, but I know some people, there will be some pretty hardcore science, and there'll be a bit of a breakthrough, and it can be, I guess, a challenge. But that's probably more interesting, and especially something that's complicated. If you want to be able to protect, you've got to explain what it is in a way that covers other things, and not just this complicated thing that they've done. So that's probably quite an enjoyable thing rather than a drawback, I think. Yep.
Is migration between firms reasonably common? Do people tend to stay with the
trade? I think there is a reasonable amount of movement between around sort of private practice, but I think once someone becomes an associate or partner, they're going to want to stay there, and less likely to. But before that stage, if people aren't getting on with a particular firm, they don't think there's prospects for becoming a partner, they'll definitely move to another firm. People definitely switch between private practice and industry, and vice versa, just to have a different view on things before you figure out what you want to do eventually. So yeah, you're not sort of, especially once you're qualified, you're quite sought after, because there's only a small number of qualified people in the UK, and yeah, you should be able to get a job other places. Yep.
How long does it take to become a partner? What kind of percentage of attorneys eventually become a partner?
That's a difficult question. Well, basically, the partnership has to be offered to you. So it's very much a question about your firm, how many partners they have already. If there's a partner about to retire and a gap opens, if the partners like you enough that they're worried you might leave, and they'll make a space for you, even if it means their profits are shared out a bit less. How long? I think probably 8 to 10 years, possibly. But it could be faster at other firms. It depends. We've got quite a large number of partners, so probably they don't want to add that many partners that frequently.
Thanks. So I'm Sarah Johnson, an associate at Hogan Lovells in the IP department. I mainly practice in patents. In fact, I exclusively do patents now, although I started off doing more mixed IP. I mainly litigate as well. What I'm going to talk about is what IP solicitors do. Because of my background, it will be predominantly patent city practice focused. I'll just explain what some of the people in my department did before they got to where they are. And then I'll talk a little bit about our firm and our IP practice, and how you qualify to be a lawyer, an IP lawyer, and the application process. So, first of all, the first question is, which one of you raised, is why go into law? And in particular, into intellectual property. I think the biggest thing is communication. You have to enjoy language, enjoy using it to put your ideas across. Teamwork is a very important part of being a solicitor in particular. Essentially, when your clients come to you with a case, you as solicitor are sat there right in the middle, coordinating everything, helping them with their legal arguments. You'll be liaising with the client about what they want. You will be liaising with barristers if you're going to go to court, with experts if it's technical or scientific. You'll also be liaising with lots of other people generally in your firm if it's a big case to deal with different disciplines, like, for example, tax and corporate banking might be relevant. As a scientist, what appealed to me as well was a scientific approach to problem solving. Law does have a set of rules. You know your commercial objective and you know what you want to achieve, and then you have to work out how you can apply those rules to get where you want to be. The other good thing about being a lawyer, and for me an IP lawyer, is getting to know people in the industry that you're working with. So you get to get an in-track view on particular industries and fields of science. And I think a big plus is the clients that you get to work with, particularly in IP. I tend to work with innovator pharmaceutical companies and mobile phone companies. And you know, they're producing cutting edge technology. They are interesting people to work with. So what does an IP solicitor do? You can see that half the page there is patents, because that's what I know about. So we help clients discuss patenting strategies. Jimmy touched on this, you know, what sort of jurisdictions you might want to patent, where you'll keep your patent alive, because it's expensive to maintain them on the register. If someone else is going to come along and make your product, if they infringe, or equally, if you want to make a particular product and you're worried about someone else's patent, ways you can get around that. We also, on the non-contentious side, help with contracts and licenses and assignments. These are worth an awful lot of money in the industry, so it's important to make sure we get them right. They can quite often be exciting deals. When you have big corporate deals as well, mergers and acquisitions, etc., intellectual property can quite often be really important, because that's often one of the largest assets a business has. And so we'll get involved just making sure that all the IP is assigned properly, etc. And then litigation, which is what I do. We will sometimes get involved in oppositions to patents at the European Patent Office. We do that in common with patent attorneys. There are a lot of patent attorneys involved in that process. We'll also get involved in infringement and revocation actions. So again, if somebody is accusing you of infringing their patent, or you're accusing them, we'll take it to court. This can quite often involve several jurisdictions, as Jim has mentioned, because if they have a patent which is registered in several different states, and for example, you make your product in one state and then you import it to another state, you're going to have to litigate in all those jurisdictions. And then the other thing we do is revocation actions, which are generally tied to infringement actions, where if someone sues you for infringement, generally what you'll do is you'll sue them back saying their patent's invalid. So the sorts of industries we cover, as I've mentioned, are life sciences. One of the biggest cases I was involved in was to do with anti-inflammatory drugs. Industrial engineering, I've been involved in chemical process type disputes, chemicals, plastics, and software and communications. And I think the big thing that you'll probably all be aware of is all the mobile phone companies are at each other's throats at the moment. So there's a lot of litigation in the courts at the moment. Other areas of IP you might do would be trademarks. We have a trademark prosecution practice where you help clients register trademarks. You also can litigate trademarks if somebody else is using your mark, or if they are dressing up their product in such a way as to make it look like your product. I think a classic case you might remember was Asda's Penguin Biscuits, Penguin Puffin dispute. That's quite a while ago, but that sort of thing where you have rip-offs, it can lead to quite fruity litigation. Custom seizures are something that we're involved in quite a lot. I know my German colleagues go along and get involved in that, where customs officers will see something that looks like an infringing product, and then they'll send it to the brand owner and follow that up. And then again, there's licensing issues with that. Copyright, we have a smallish copyright practice, again, to do with licensing and ownership and giving advice about people's rights. How is this different to what patent attorneys and barristers do? We don't liaise with inventors about prosecuting their patents. We tend not to have anything to do with that at all. The first we'll get involved is once a patent has been granted. We might, as I said, be involved in oppositions in the European Patent Office, where we try and get the patent revoked, or where you've got infringement issues, we will litigate in the courts. Where Jimmy will be working with the inventor to define the scope of the monopoly of the patent, we will be working to try and interpret the scope. Once the patent's been granted, there are certain legal rules you have to follow to determine how the patent should be construed and exactly what the monopoly is. And it can be quite tricky and can quite often lead to, I suppose, surprising results. Barristers, what's different with them? They tend to be trial specialists, so they don't get involved in the day-to-day running of a case from the beginning to the end. They come in at certain key points and they'll give you advice as to procedure and how the court is going to, or is likely to, approach certain questions put before it. They tend also to work as sole practitioners, or you know, on a very big case you might have a senior and one or more juniors, but essentially you're not working in the same big teams that we have in private practice. Not all my cases are big teams, just to make that clear. I mean, if you've got a smaller case, you'll have fewer lawyers on it. Right, so my department, we've got, I'd say we probably do 40% of us are patent litigators, and then we've got about 30% trademark lawyers, and then the rest do copyright. And we also, part of our department does software contracts, outsourcing contracts, and data protection issues. So here are various people in my department. Laura and Mark qualified at the same time in 2007, I believe. Laura read chemistry at UCL, and then she went straight on to do her law conversion and qualified into the department, as I said, in 2007. Mark read biochemistry, and again went straight on to do law conversion training contract. Stella had a slightly different approach. She qualified as a doctor first. She worked in UCH for 3 years. Then she qualified as a GP. And then she decided to do her law conversion, which she did part-time whilst working as a GP. And that took 2 years for the GDL. And then she did full-time LPC because Lovells picked her up at that point. And then her training contract, and then she qualified. I read chemistry here. I then decided to do the BVC, thinking I wanted to be a barrister, then changed my mind, so I paralegaled for a while, took on a training contract, and then qualified. Emma read law and got a training contract pretty much straight out of law school. Dom did microbiology, and then he did a PhD. And then he was picked up in the last year of his PhD, and again went straight on to the law conversion and training contract. a IP diploma there because our firm makes all IP lawyers do an IP diploma here at Oxford. It was at Bristol and we moved, they moved it 2 years ago to Oxford. And it is a year-long course with a two-week residential course in September. And then you have various assignments throughout the year and then two exams in the summer. And it covers all aspects of intellectual property law. And as Jimmy mentioned, it can be quite interesting trying to fit that around a full-time job as well. But we all managed to survive somehow. So what have I been involved in? One of the biggest cases I've done is trade secrets litigation, where we had a tip-off. Our client had a tip-off that they're an engineering firm and that somebody was ripping off their parts using their technical drawings. So based on this, we got a search order on an ex parte basis, i.e. we didn't tip off the naughty people. Went to the court, they gave us a search order. We thought we'd be there for a day. We were there for 4 days. They had so much stuff. They had something like 3,000 technical drawings and a secret database based in Germany. They'd scanned them all in. That is still going on, major piece of litigation. We managed to get one guy sent down for contempt of court because he tried to delete the database when we turned up. And fortunately, we had very clever people from Deloitte to find it again. So that's been interesting because you don't often see search orders. I mentioned the mobile phone patent litigation. That was keeping me very busy until the other side folded, which it's great for our client, less great for me. I've been involved in medical devices litigation at the moment. I've got an action before the Patents County Court. You may be aware that they have a new judge who's just started sitting in the last few weeks. So it's interesting for us to be before the new judge, and there's new procedural rules that have come in place. So, you know, it's nice to be at the forefront of that. Another medical device spat related to a big licensing dispute where we were acting for a client who was given a license to operate somebody's technology, and you have to get various regulatory approvals before you can put things like that on the market, and there were issues about when it was put on the market, etc., etc. So that was interesting because it didn't actually lead to litigation, but was very interesting to get involved in all the correspondence between the companies, all the internal workings of the companies to understand exactly what happened, and we had to figure out why things had happened the way they happened. And then we've had patent oppositions. The medical device in question was catheters, which isn't a particularly nice subject. One of my colleagues' rooms is full of catheters, the glamour of IP. And as I mentioned, an inflammatory drug. And that went right up to appeal. So a bit about my firm. We're a very big firm. We're top 10 by revenue in the world. We have offices in 22 countries and over 3,200 lawyers. Obviously, not all firms are like this. And when you are thinking about applying, you really need to consider if this is the sort of firm you want to join, or if you'd prefer to have a more national firm or a smaller firm. Our IP team has 389 lawyers. I think we counted that in May. And specialists and paralegals and 78 partners. We cover all aspects of IP across Europe, US and Asia. We have bespoke IP teams in 30 offices covering 14 jurisdictions. I think that's great. A big part of my job, as I've mentioned, is doing international actions. And you can, within a day or two, find out answers to legal questions across all these jurisdictions by pinging out emails to your international colleagues. And then you can work with them on big pieces of international litigation. And I find that exciting. Again, when you're thinking about applying, it's up to you if you consider that exciting. And here's an indication of where all our offices are. So you can see we've got a big United States presence. You may be aware that we merged with Hogan's earlier in the year. Hence, we now have a large global reach, larger than it was. So how do you apply? generally, you apply for a vacation scheme, or if you haven't done a vacation scheme, you apply for a training contract, and then you'll come to an assessment day. At the assessment day, you will have a critical thinking test and an interview and a team sort of case study on a business scenario. Then you do your GDL. We prefer you to do it BPP because we have the LPC accelerated program at BPP. Then you do your training contract, which is 2 years. You have 4 6-month seats. One of those seats you can do a secondment. We offer international secondments. I can't remember them all offhand, but it includes, I think, Singapore. Forgive me if I get this wrong. Paris, Brussels, and other international offices. Or you can do 6 months at a client. We've got a wide range of clients that take on secondees, such as Ford, Merck, John Lewis, Save the Children. And then you qualify. And then when you qualify, we advertise what vacancies are available in what department, and you apply to the department and hopefully get into the department of your choice. If not, we have a second round and you can perhaps try to get into a different department. These are dates for your diary. My graduate recruitment team has asked me to leave out a selection of bookmarks on the side which have these dates on them. So we operate open days for non-law students in December and January. You'll need to apply pretty soon, the 12th of November, or next year in March, and you need to apply by the end of January. The vacation schemes operate over 3 weeks between June and July. I think there are two sittings for those, and you need to apply between October and January 2011. And then the training contract applications, you'll need to apply if you're a non-lawyer by the end of April, and if you're a lawyer by the end of July. Just a word of advice on that. The deadlines aren't necessarily a good date to operate by. I'd get your applications in early because they will offer places as and when they find suitable people. And if you leave it to the deadline, you may miss out. Otherwise, good luck. And are there any questions?
With the summer vacation scheme, is that for penultimate students?
I think it's final year non-lawyer students and penultimate lawyers.
Are the majority of your IP solicitors from non-law backgrounds?
Certainly on the patent side, we're mainly scientists, but we do have lawyers. On the trademark side and the so-called soft IP, there are more lawyers there as well, more straight lawyers, as it were. And then throughout the firm, I can't tell you the exact figures, but there's a good mixture of people who did law degrees or non-law degrees.
Can I ask two questions?
Yeah.
Firstly, do you think that it's a bit of a risk to apply to a very big city firm like Lovells or Simmons & Simmons, for instance, hoping to qualify into their IP departments when things like corporate and the financial departments are so big and will have more openings at the end of the training contract?
Personally, I think that the benefits of training in one of those firms outweighs the risk of not getting into their IP department because they've got enormous resources to invest into you. I'm not saying that you don't get trained well at smaller firms, because you do. I just know that I enjoyed my training. I had exposure to really interesting clients and cases throughout. I had lots of courses laid on, and then I qualified at the end. You know, you may or may not get a space in IP. It just depends on, you know, the business needs at the time of the department and how many vacancies there are and who's qualifying with you. But, you know, there are other firms that will be recruiting if you miss out.
And secondly, if you do the accelerated LPC, does that mean that Lovells are giving less in the way of a grant that for the people who've got training contracts than firms who make you do the whole full year?
Yeah, I don't know what the rate is, but we give a grant of, I think it's £8,000 in London and £7,000 out of London for the accelerated LPC.
Oh, okay, so it's still comparable to firms that are doing full year LPC.
Okay, so I'm out of touch, I'm afraid.
I've got one, so did you consider patent becoming a patent attorney?
I didn't, because by the time I got onto my master's, I realised that I wasn't really a technical chemist. And what really interested me was more being in the law and being on the business end and working towards a commercial end. And that's why, for me, law was the area I wanted to go into.
Do you find your work particularly pressured? Because we were talking about paperwork being, like, there are loads and loads of deadlines.
Yeah.
And do you find that you end up working late quite often?
Yes and no. If you do mainly non-contentious work, you can often work really long hours for intense periods, and then there'll be periods where you don't work quite so hard because you'll be working to the deadlines of your client. And sometimes it can be a little bit unpredictable because they might not necessarily know themselves, or they might not tell you. With litigation, there are moments when it's very pressured. If you're coming up to trial or if you're drafting your expert reports, yes, you'll be working long hours because you are working to very strict timetables set by the court, and the court is not going to let those slip. But other times, it's fine. I mean, if you're working in a city firm, you're going to expect some pressure.
Other than your IP seat in your training contract, which other seats or suits did you particularly enjoy, if at all? Are there areas of law that you maybe didn't think you were going to enjoy?
Which seats did I do? I did capital markets, which I don't know if you know, that's kind of drafting the contracts underlying securitising mortgages, that sort of thing. I did banking litigation, and I did a secondment at ExxonMobil. Oh yes, and I also did another banking seat. They were varied. I enjoyed litigation a lot more, and that's how, you know, by the end of the 2 years, I realised I wanted to be a litigator because I just enjoyed the process and I enjoyed the way you draft arguments. And the secondment was really good because you get a lot more autonomy. Because I mean, the thing is, particularly in a large firm, as a junior lawyer, you're not going to be left in charge of a case because they're too big. You'll be working with a partner, maybe a senior associate, maybe a couple other junior lawyers. On client secondment, you're dealing with smaller cases for clients within the company, and quite often you're just left to run those yourself, and that was really good. And the other thing that I did in my training contract, which I still do, was pro bono work. And again, that gives you more autonomy and responsibility.
Perhaps we could just show appreciation and concern, Jimmy, for giving her time this evening, giving her time to spend with those two.